The United Nations Summit on the Millennium Development Goals that took place in September of 2010 concluded with the adoption of a global action plan to achieve the 8 anti-poverty goals by their 2015 target date. And among them was a call for the reduction of the proportion of people without sustainable access to safe drinking water by half between 1990 and 2015. Yet an estimated 884 million people in the world, 37% of whom live in sub-Saharan Africa, still use unimproved sources of drinking water. Lack of access to safe drinking water contributes to a staggering burden of diarrheal diseases worldwide, particularly affecting the young and the immunocompromised and poor. Nearly 1 in 5 child deaths, about 1.5 million each year, is due to diarrhea, which kills more than young children than AIDS, malaria, and measles combined. So what can be done about this massive problem in global health, and why is it so important? Joining me this morning to tell us more about the problem and just what is being done is Dr. Timothy Dye, adjunct professor of public health and preventive medicine at Upstate Medical University and the former director of the Center for Research and Evaluation at Upstate. And he is now the associate dean for research and professor of public health in the Falk College of Sport and Human Dynamics at Syracuse University. Also joining us with him is Mary Ann Sandiford Day, and she's a Master's of Public Health student in the Central New York Master's of Public Health at Upstate and SU program. It's a combined program. Welcome to you both. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Well, that was a long mouthful, basically, and it sounds to me like clean water has been set as a global priority. Mary Ann, tell us about this problem. Why is it so important?
Well, I think because throughout the world, we come to accept clean water as just a given. But even in this country 100 years ago, people were dying of diarrhea and diseases related to unclean water. This exists in the developing world, and particularly in rural areas.
Mm-hmm. And the diarrhea, as I said in the introduction, is a source of major issues in terms of health and longevity, right, Tim?
Yeah, the diarrhea around the world is a major cause of mortality, particularly in children, but not only in children. And it's related to both contaminated water and the lack of water for washing and cleaning and things of that sort, and also the prevalence of parasites and other bugs that sort of cause the problems to begin with.
But we're seeing it, as I said earlier, that there's a majority of this taking place in sub-Saharan Africa.
Sure.
Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it's around the world. I think the only places I've ever been where waterborne diseases were not a problem are North America and Europe for the most part. Throughout Asia, South America, Central America, Africa, the South Pacific, waterborne diseases are a big problem in having access to clean water. Both for health purposes and to prevent parasite infection and problems like that. It's a big problem worldwide.
So you personally, Tim, in your role currently, set this as a goal to do what? To study?
Well, it's interesting because my work in diarrhea goes back 20 years, and my first study on childhood diarrhea was in Kashmir in northern India in the late 1980s. And looking at how people perceive of diarrhea, what causes it, because it's the major cause of death of children in that part of the world as well. And if people don't understand some basics about how diarrhea is caused and how it's related to water and how to best treat it, then the child gets severely dehydrated pretty quickly. And it's hard to intervene if people don't have a sense of what's causing the problem. If you think, for example, your child is cursed or it's just a natural thing and it's not related to water, then you can continue to feed them contaminated water and they get sicker and sicker.
Mm, so that clearly education or information sharing is crucial in that. And we're going to get into that more because I know you've basically been involved in quite an extensive study as to what attitudes and ideas are underlying this issue. Sure. Tell us how you got involved in this, Mary Ann.
Well, as students in Tim's class, there were just 5 of us, and we had a very interesting group. 2 of the students were from India, 1 was from Africa, another student was a student of medical anthropology.
And this is a Master's of Public Health that
yes,
you're involved
yes,
in.
Yes, one of our first courses that we took as an elective course. And so everyone was coming from different fields.
But what was your field?
Well, I had been home for a while doing volunteer work. Prior to that, I'd done lab work for a brewing company and marketing research.
Quite far afield.
Quite far. And this program was just a wonderful introduction to our community, so that just worked out great for me. So regarding the water, it's shocking when you're not in the field to suddenly read that this is what's causing most of the
infant mortality and death
after the perinatal conditions. Yes, it's just shocking, and that it's these are simple solutions that can't seem to be found or utilized.
Mm-hmm. And Tim, in your case, you said you've been doing this kind of research for years, and I do know we had you on another show where we talked about your work in Antarctica. You seem to be heading into the far reaches of our world. What intrigues you there?
Well, it's always been an interest to look at what's going on in other cultures, and I think in my own case, I've been very interested in isolated and remote communities around the world and how they handle public health problems. So, you know, this area of water is a big one. First of all, having access to it to begin with, and then having access to clean water is an important issue worldwide that there aren't a lot of solutions that have been successful, oddly. You know, there's a lot of work that's been going on in this field for decades, and a lot of things haven't worked, you know. So that's been intriguing for a public health scientist to try to figure out how can we deal with this problem in a more efficient way.
Well, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought, and because we have a lot more to talk about. I want to really understand more about what you did find and what interventions have worked, but we have to take a short break right now. We're going to be right back. I'm Linda Cohen. This is HealthLink on Air, and stay right there because I think you'll be very interested in the rest of this conversation. This is HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYL. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen, along with my guests, public health specialist Dr. Tim Dye and Mary Ann Sandiford Day. And we're talking about the importance of clean water in third world countries in controlling disease and infant death or death for children. But before the break, Tim, you were talking about the fact that many things have been tried in terms of affecting clean water throughout the world globally, but yet they haven't been successful. And what seem to be the obstacles in terms of this?
Well, the issues that I'm familiar with, I've seen interventions like, for example, digging wells. I've been to a lot of places where there are dysfunctional wells that were, you know, dug a decade or so ago, and they require maintenance, and a lot of organizations come in, they dig a well in a community, works great for a little while, and then goes kaput, and they don't have anybody trained in fixing it, so that source of clean water could be gone.
So it's resources and money in some cases.
In that example, yeah. And then in other examples, one of the most common household interventions is to boil water and boil it at a certain temperature. Well, that's resource intensive. If you're in Africa, there's not a lot of wood in a lot of places, or coal or dung to burn. And sometimes boiling water becomes a resource intensive activity, and it's kind of inconvenient for people. And after a while, you don't really keep that up either. Chemical interventions or chemicals that you can put in water, those can be expensive, difficult to obtain. People don't like the taste of the water. It doesn't fit naturally with the way they live. So that hasn't worked very well. Having reservoirs or water tanks, that requires an infrastructure, again, that's in poorer areas, these things aren't easy to maintain or sustain financially. So in some areas they might work, but in other areas, particularly in the lower resource areas, that doesn't work either. So,
and it struck me earlier that you said, and both of you were talking about the fact that attitudes play a role here, very much so as well. I mean, if you don't have the connection that the water or the lack of clean water is causing an illness or a problem, then you don't have the motivation, perhaps, to even change it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's true. And I think one of the things that we particularly realized in this most recent study, people do understand the connection now. Certainly in a lot of places, there's a lot of education out there.
Okay.
UNICEF is doing a ton of work on water education. But what people are seeing is that it's just an inevitable fact of life. You just can't do anything about it. You're poor. You don't have any money for food. You know, buying fuel to boil your water is just not at the top of your priority list. So people just live with it, and they get sick. They know they get sick because of the water, but there's not much that they see that they can do about it. So it's kind of a frustrating situation, I think, for families.
So, Marianne, you've been involved as part of this study we're going to talk about in an intervention that has worked. Is that correct? Tell us about that.
Yes, well, I actually did some of the background research on water filtration and water cleaning devices, point-of-use devices for households and individuals.
So when you say point-of-use, explain that. What does that mean?
That would be for an individual to use or for a family unit to use, not a water cleansing for a whole community or anything like that.
Just not a reservoir. We're not talking about wells, reservoirs. You're talking about point-of-use meaning something right then, maybe at the tap or the source, wherever their water is coming from.
And immediately before ingestion, so it can't be contaminated with hands or other sources.
Yeah. So what kind of research, what did you come up with, and what has been used?
Well, we found several studies had been done on cleaning water for families and individuals, and actually we found that water filters were one of the most acceptable types because of their simplicity and lack of parts, lack of having to do too many repairs, et cetera, et cetera. So they were a very good possibility to get the use implemented.
And has that happened, Tim? So are they using these water filtration systems? And
We worked with Vestergaard Franzen is the manufacturer of these and other kinds of interventions in low-resource communities. And they supported this huge intervention, actually, that involved 40-some-odd thousand people in rural Kenya. One of the things that they did is they distributed filters that would be like it's called a life straw. It's just a straw, basically, that you carry around your neck, and you can drink out of any water source, and it has a filtration mechanism that, you know, some guy could be out hunting and just go up to a pool of water and use this filtration system, and you're able to suck up clean water.
If I may say, that's incredible.
Oh, it's great.
I mean, it sounds so logical and so simple, but how does it in effect work? Is it effective?
Yeah, so what we were brought in to do is to look at how people receive these devices. So the people who got the devices as part of their campaign, it's called the Integrated Prevention Campaign, we went in to see how people responded to these devices. Did they use them? Was it a situation where only men had them and women didn't have access to them, and all of that? And we did an anthropological study. And actually, we found, first of all, people understood the causes of diarrhea and they understood problems with water. So that was an important piece of it. The other part of it is they were using these devices. There were a few problems here and there with a device breaking, or they didn't like a taste. It has like a carbon taste. It's certainly initially, and some people didn't like that. But for the most part, people liked the devices, used the devices. They talked about being healthier, being able to work more, save money on fuel. And there's a big device called the family water filter, right? Mm-hmm. A family water filter that women received in this intervention, and it is a bigger mechanism that allows the woman to create drinkable water for the family. And it's a bigger volume than just the straw. The straw is more sort of a portable kind of
personal
thing.
Item.
And, you know, these things worked really well. And huge numbers of people got these as part of a set of interventions. The other interventions related to HIV/AIDS and malaria. And this was relating to water sanitation.
So it was, I mean, obviously they did a study. Did they find that there was a great reduction in the amount of diarrhea and water-related illnesses following this?
We haven't measured the reduction of disease. That's ongoing as part of Vestergaard Franzen's evaluation. Our evaluation was to look at whether people used these things or they sold them or did they not know what to do with them. And we found that they knew what they were doing with the devices. They liked the devices. They knew that they needed devices. They weren't having any success with the other mechanisms. So these point-of-use water filtration products really were quite helpful in the communities that were in this part of Kenya.
And there were no obstacles. I mean, obviously what you mentioned before is that there could be some cultural prohibitions to something of that nature. I don't know. I mean, you don't know when you go into a culture how things are going to be received. And you're saying, in fact, they were welcomed, they were used, and what's to be followed up on is whether, in fact, they did limit or curtail the amount of disease.
All right, and if use is sustained. We looked at this pretty soon after the initial distribution. They were well-received. People liked them. They saw immediate benefits, which was very helpful, because when you see an immediate benefit, you tend to stick with it. Whether things we really need to go back and see now a year or two later, are people still using the devices? Do they break down or sort of fall away from it? Just like the mosquito nets and the other things that were part of the campaign, do they continue to use them or does the fad sort of wear off? My guess is that since they're getting clean water out of this and there's an immediate reaction to that, I think it's a pretty sustainable intervention.
What I'm curious about is, from a financial standpoint, how sustainable is it? In other words, Vestergaard Franssen was supplying these at no cost to the families or the individuals. Is that something that's going to continue? Where will the funds come from for this to be sustained? And how long does a filter work for? I mean, in other words, is this, what's the natural life history of any of these, the life straw or any of these kinds of filters?
Marion, did you find that out in your work with Haiti on this?
Yes, and they last a long time, like a couple of years, depending on, say, for a family of four, the family filter can last a couple of years.
Wow.
Depending, of course, upon what the volume is. And they're simple.
And it sounds like not many moving parts, so the likelihood of them breaking down is less than if they were more complex.
Right, the bigger home version has more moving parts, and I know a few people in our study had mentioned them. Kids were playing with it and broke a piece. And so there's a bit of maintenance that's required for that. And I think the funding question, that's a big one. I think, you know, how this is going to be financially sustainable sort of beyond this period of a demonstration project is a big question. I think the expectation is that governments will invest in this kind of community level intervention, since the other interventions are far more expensive and take far more infrastructure to maintain over the long term. So perhaps aid organizations and governments will take some of these opportunities when they're, you know, feasible in a particular community and there isn't any other way to deal with the water situation.
I think it sounds amazing. I mean, it sounds simple, portable, and it sounds like it's not presenting any kind of obstacles in terms of their acceptance, the people's acceptance. Are you looking to do this kind of analysis elsewhere? I mean, are these programs being, obviously the need is great globally, as you said, so are companies like Vestergaard Franssen continuing to look at other areas, or are you going to be looking at other areas to see about acceptance of these kinds of devices?
Well, certainly. Marianne was actually involved in another class on another project for Vestergaard where they wanted to do this in Haiti. So maybe
yes.
You could maybe address
and
that.
Our project on Haiti, the timing was immediately after the earthquake. And as we were planning another integrated prevention campaign where we look at all the different diseases that are the most important in that area, Vestergaard was already in Haiti distributing water filters.
Wow.
I don't know of any assessment that's been done to see how effective or how much they've been used by the people there.
Well, you know, I can't tell you how impressive this is to me, because it sounds so, first of all, so crucial, but also so simple and doable. Obviously, I don't know the need for the financial sustenance for it. But I want to thank you, Dr. Timothy Dye, adjunct professor of public health and preventive medicine at Upstate Medical University, and Marianne Sandiford Day, master of public health student.
Thank you
so much for coming in, sharing this very important information. It's very, very hopeful in terms of our world issue with clean water. We have to take another short break. We're going to be right back, so please stay there. I'm Linda Cohen. This is HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.